For this and all Clinical Updates podcasts, a 0.25 AMA PRA Category 1 credit will be available for a limited time. To claim credit, view the slide deck associated with this podcast and complete the evaluation found in the slides. Speakers, planners, and CME staff do not have any relevant financial relationships with ineligible companies to disclose.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to our podcast. Today, I have Dr. Troy Payne. Hello, Troy, and thank you for doing this.
Good morning.
We are going to be talking about parasomnias, which sounds like the title of a horror movie. And I'm so excited about this because this is scientifically and just anecdotally fascinating. So we'll try to make it as scientifically appealing as possible. I'll try not to get too tempted about anecdotes and stuff like that. So with that, let's get right into it. How would you define a parasomnia?
Well, it was originally described parasomnia, just meaning something that happened at night. You know, something beside that happened in the middle of the night. So these were the weird things that happened at night. And good gracious, you can't read Shakespeare or any of the old text or anything without running into somebody who had some sort of weird thing that happened at night.
So while that was a non-scientific way to, and I'm sure many of our cute and not cute stories come down from that. Now, every time in medicine we say para is kind of what's not normal. Now, in sleep medicine, there are things like narcolepsy and sleep apnea. Are those parasomnias or not, and how you differentiate?
No. The ones that are the things that we typically think of a lot in medicine, like obstructive sleep apnea is a physiologic thing, you know, where you can't get enough air down at night, or narcolepsy, where you don't make a particular chemical in your brain to keep you awake during the day. But there is overlap. So there are parasomnias that can happen within those. We sort of separate the parasomnias as these weird things that happen. So it's a sort of a loose definition. But for instance, in narcolepsy, you can wake up in the morning and be totally paralyzed, and there's someone standing right next to you. Well, that's a part of the REM sleep that escaped a little bit into daytime. So in REM sleep, normally your muscles are partially paralyzed, but you know it's not supposed to happen when you're awake. But if it carries over a little bit, you can be paralyzed when you wake up. Well, that's sleep paralysis, and you can get sleep paralysis without narcolepsy too. Particularly if you've been up all night, you've been drinking a little bit, some of those kind of things can cause sleep paralysis too. Or you can see somebody that's in the room that is not there, hypnopompic hallucination, a bit of a dream sleep that escapes into daytime. But there's lots of different parasomnias that are out there. Probably the most common that people are aware of is if they've ever had a kid, because most kids sleepwalk at some point in their life.
Now, I certainly don't want to deviate, but this is pathophysiology or physiology of sleep. What's the evolutionary benefit of having REM sleep? You are so vulnerable. What's the point of reaching REM? What's the benefit of it or the need of it?
The short answer is we don't know.
Okay.
In this day. But the long answer is that it seems to be very important for memory formation. We're finding out more and more that when you're asleep and you're in deep non-REM sleep, the glymphatic system, the system that washes away a lot of the buildup byproducts that we have in the day, that if they build up too much can be toxic. If you don't get enough sleep, that glymphatic system in non-REM, that happens mostly in non-REM sleep, is really important for clearing things out. And if it doesn't work, there's an increased risk of dementia. In REM sleep, if you don't get enough REM sleep, that causes all kinds of issues with memory, and you have difficulty remembering things. Everything falls apart a little bit as we get older. And I'm not talking about just, you know, you can't remember the last name of somebody, you know, you met last week. But even more serious memory kind of issues, including we've wondered about, you know, what is the relationship between neurodegeneration disorders and our issues that we have both with our lymphatic system and non-REM sleep, and how the acetylcholine system works in REM sleep. You can suppress REM sleep with certain medications like SSRIs or tricyclics or anything that involves the cholinergic system can too. And so some of those things are now coming out that if you, you know, if you're on an anticholinergic, which is very, you know, the cholinergic system is all REM. And if you suppress that for year after year after year, that's not good for your memory in the long run. Mm. So this is a new field in neurology right now, looking at some of this.
Yeah, as I was telling you before we record, I'm fascinated with sleep as it's like this involuntary ability we have to shut down the office and do housekeeping until the employees come back the next day. But anyway, I know there are many ways to classify, but I wonder if we could, for practical purposes, classify the parasomnias as mild and anecdotal, or, you know, something that is okay, of no major consequence, versus some that are severe, and how could somebody detect them or scout for it if you're doing primary care?
Absolutely. So there's common ones that are very benign, and we stress safety issues, but things like sleep talking, which is very common, sleep walking, which is very common, even night terrors in young children, though they sound terrible at the time, you know, those things are something you can work through, and they're not going to cause any major issue for the vast, vast, vast majority of people. But there are parasomnias that are the signs of underlying severe issues, and probably mm-hmm. the classic one there is REM sleep behavior disorder. So we do not know why it's more common in men, but if you have a male in your family practice clinic over the age of 60 usually, and they usually come in with a bed partner, and the bed partner says, "I'm very concerned. He was strangling me again last week in his sleep, and I had to bop him in the nose to get him off of me." And the poor guy, he's the nicest, sweetest guy you've ever met. And he'll say, and he's so embarrassed. And he'll say, "She tells me this has been going on for about a year, but it's getting worse. I'm having these nightmares, and they're very violent nightmares where I'm being chased, I'm being stabbed, or she's being stabbed, or..." And, you know, when this happened last week, I was dreaming that we were leaving the movie theater and there was someone trying to mug us, and I had to get this guy away from us. And then I woke mm-hmm. up when she hit me in the nose. And so they're acting out their dreams actively. Mm-hmm. And when you do a sleep study on some of these people, what you'll see is that the normal muscle tone that's supposed to go down in REM sleep paradoxically actually goes up higher instead of uh-huh. down. So this is a sign that there's something really wrong in the system that tries to regulate all the neurochemicals and everything. And these people have about 60 to 80% chance of developing Parkinson's disease within the next 5 years.
Wow.
And so I've been doing this now for my 28th year in sleep medicine this summer. So I've done this long enough that I have seen dozens and dozens and dozens of, you know, high functioning, you know, lawyers and, you know, people that, you know, came into the office like this and watched them develop Parkinson's. I've also seen people with Parkinson's come in and say they do this, and you go, "Yep." And they say, "My Parkinson's doctor knows all about this. My neurologist said it's REM sleep behavior disorder." I go, "Yep, probably is." And the reason why neurologists that see Parkinson's patients know this so frequently is probably half of all people with Parkinson's do this at some point. Some more, some less. So that's the one that's the classic that's dangerous, because you can have this one and not even know that you're going to be at increased risk for worse things down the road.
So for practical purposes, the more worrisome ones are the ones that, and I apologize for putting in non-scientific terms, but people acting out their dreams pretty
yes.
much.
If you had to pick one thing, that would be it. No. And you can have REM sleep behavior disorder in people who have narcolepsy and certain other disorders, too. Yeah. In fact, you can even have some of that happen sometimes after just starting on a tricyclic, an SRI or an SNRI, and then it will disappear when you stop the medicine. And we thought that was interesting. So it was all caused by the medicine, right? But what we found out is that a lot of those people will come back to you 10 years, 15 years later and say, "Now I'm doing it and I'm not on any of those medicines." So even if it was caused by the medicine, it's probably more like unmasked by the medicine. And if you get off the medicine, it'll go away, but it might come back later. And we're trying to figure out who it will come back on and who it won't, using really high powered MRIs, looking at specific brain anatomy in order to try to figure that out right now. it's a high place of research right now.
Okay. Now, when you mentioned earlier, I'm sure you heard this joke. I think it's either if you remember the 60s or the 70s, you didn't have fun or something like that. But with that joke in mind, something that is not a joke is there are so many young people, by young I mean under 20, on SSRIs, and if this is lifelong, who knows what's going to lay ahead of, you know, 5-6 decades of an SSRI for dementia, you know, or profound memory issues and behavior alteration. Is that something that is being discussed in the research field?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
And honestly, we don't know much about much of that at this point.
Of course.
Yeah. I mean, and you're always balancing things, of course. Mm-hmm. You know, if somebody needs an SSRI to get through right now, well, then we mm-hmm. should.
Sure.
But we don't know some of the long-term side effects on some of these medicines. Some of them we've had for many, many years and appear to be pretty safe.
Like the older ones.
Exactly. But we just don't know.
Okay. Now, before we move on, I really have to ask about sexsomnia, and this is a completely non-scientific part of the conversation, but come on, let's have some fun. What is that one about?
Yeah, when you go through the list of all the things, there's usually a couple things that people go, what's that?
Yeah.
So sexsomnia is more common in men. Mm-hmm. It's more commonly in young men. Mm-hmm. And it is, you can think of it like sleepwalking. It's an involuntary thing. The person does not know they're doing it. They have no recollection of doing it, but they will rub up against anyone that's in bed with them. And
that's a hard sell that you don't know, right? Okay, that's a tough diagnosis.
Yeah, it is. I've seen it a handful of times. It is not common. Mm-hmm. And most of the time, someone's drunk, someone withdrawing from being drunk, someone is disinhibited from a medication or substance, but they have no recollection of any of it, none at all.
Okay.
And some people aren't on any medications, have no alcohol, have no withdrawal, have nothing, and do this anyway. And most of those people I've found were terrible sleepwalkers as kids.
Okay.
So they were prone to some of this kind of, that's a non-REM parasomnia. It happens in non-REM sleep.
Interesting.
The other one interesting that you hear about is exploding head syndrome.
I never heard of it, but I saw it in your slides. What is about that one?
So you know how you're falling asleep and you feel that little jerk?
The hypnagogic?
Exactly, a hypnic jerk. Yeah. It's the same thing, except that instead of happening in the motor area, it happens in the occipital cortex. So you get a flash of light, like poof, as you're falling asleep, that's totally painless. There is no headache, no migraine, no headache. But there's a flash of light and a feeling that the back end of your head just fell off.
Okay, that's...
And you wake up and you go, what was that?
Yeah.
Then it's totally benign. So it's sort of like a hypnic jerk, except in the wrong, different place in your body. So it's totally benign. You might think it's really severe, but it's not.
Interesting. We could talk forever about this. Now, I'm sure with all we do with our environment, especially with the problems we have with insomnia to begin with, we have altered many things. But can you comment a little bit on how much of this is genetic and what genetics are involved? How much is environmental? If you could give a percentage of what is thought each thing contributes, each aspect?
Yeah. So yeah, if you take the most common one, sleepwalking, mm-hmm. You know, it's found in 15-20% of elementary school age kids. It's a little bit more common in boys than girls, not that much, but a little bit. But if you had a parent who was a sleepwalker, there's about a 50% chance that your kid's going to be a bad sleepwalker too.
Okay.
And so they've tried to figure out some of the genes on that. And there's a gene on chromosome 20 that they have found now that runs in families that's associated with sleepwalking. They're trying to figure out. And the chromosome has something to do with some of the neurochemistry we've been talking about a little bit. So there's definitely chromosomal things that run in families that lead to things like sleepwalking in children. And one of the things we've learned in medicine over the years is our genes get turned on and get turned off at different points in our lives. And as we mature and as we go through puberty, And that's felt to be one of the reasons why some of these things like sleepwalking are so much common in children. And then as you go through adolescence, a lot of people, it'll get turned off. Unfortunately, in some people, it doesn't get turned off and they keep doing it as adults. But a lot of the parasomnias that are common, like sleepwalking, are much more common in children.
Now, there are many parasomnias to talk about, and of course, it's not practical to get into any, but I wanted to use sleepwalking to ask you a question about the following. Let's say you said 15% of the population, right? Let's say 5% of the kids have sleepwalking in an X population, right? What I don't understand is how come that we don't have 5 out of 100 kids having electrocution, falling off stairs, falling off windows, stabbing somebody? What's going on? Because you do have some awareness of your environment. What's to that?
And every parent who has a child who sleepwalks knows this, because the child can be standing outside your bedroom door with a blank stare on their face, or just standing at the bottom of your bed. And you go, Johnny, what's going on? And Johnny doesn't respond. Or you find Johnny crawled up, you know, somewhere, and, you know, his eyes are wide open, but he's just sitting there, and he's sleepwalking, and he sleepwalked. But, you know, how did he get out of his bed? How did he come around the corner? How did he walk to your room? There has got to be, you know, visual cortex working. There's got to be motor cortex working. These things have to be coordinated. But the memory part of it is the part that gets dampened. And you as a parent can say, Johnny, go back to bed, and you can, you know, take Johnny's hand, and he'll even, you know, sometimes reach out to you and sometimes won't. But you can walk him back to bed and tuck him back in bed. And then the next morning you ask Johnny, Johnny, what were you doing standing out in the hallway? And he goes, no, I wasn't. Well, yeah, you were. Remember that I walked you back to bed? No, you didn't. Total memory loss for that. So there's parts that, you're absolutely right, there's parts that do work, and then there's parts that don't work, like memory.
But to me, the counterpart that is fascinating is we are taught that so many things go to sleep with the patient. Like I heard, like the parasympathetic, I think that's, I don't know if that's correct, the parasympathetic system sleeps with the patient, and like, you know, bowels and things like that. But then you do things that you would sound stupid if you say that they can function while you're unconscious.
I would say more dampened. It's not like it's completely offline. It's just not at the forefront. So we spend a lot of our lives, you know, with things that are higher or lower, from TSH levels to adenosine levels to your serotonin system and everything. And it's not an on-off switch. It's a complex dance.
Well, unfortunately, we are running out of time, but this is really fascinating. I'm really thankful for you to do this short conversation. The last question is, if somebody has any concerns or questions with their patient, they refer to you or to a neurology? How does that work?
Yeah. If it happens when person's asleep, we see them for anything. If we find out it's a nocturnal seizure or something like that, that's epilepsy, then, you know, we obviously will get them into a neurologist to do. But you can just refer to anybody here at the sleep clinic. We see pretty much anyone over age 5 at the sleep center at CentraCare. So, and we've got openings next week, so the clinic's wide open. We're very fortunate to hire 2 new full-time sleep docs within the last year and a half. So we actually have openings now. People say, oh, it takes weeks to get into the sleep center. I go, no, it doesn't. We can get into the clinic very quickly. Happy to help you.
Great advice. I'll sleep on it. Always a pleasure talking to you. You're fascinating to talk to you. Thank you so much.
No, thank you for having me.
Anytime.